It's Tuesday, May 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the United States lifts an arms embargo against Vietnam. Billions of dollars involved in a potential company merger.
He thought, over time, the younger generations will, in Vietnam will help turn the country into a new nation.
A VOA exclusive, reflections on conflict and resolution in Vietnam. Top musicians receive top awards. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. President Obama, during his first full day in Vietnam Monday, announced the lifting of a 50-year arms embargo on the Southeast Asian nation. Mr. Obama's announcement came during a joint news conference in Hanoi with his newly sworn-in counterpart, Tran Dai Quang.
As with all our defense partners, sales will need to still meet strict requirements, including those related to human rights. But this change will ensure that Vietnam has access to the equipment it needs to defend itself and removes a lingering vestige of the Cold War. It also underscores the commitment of the United States to a fully normalized relationship with Vietnam, including strong defense ties with Vietnam and this region for the long term. More broadly, the United States and Vietnam are united in our support for a regional order, including in the South China Sea, where international norms and rules are upheld, where there is freedom of navigation and overflight, where lawful commerce is not impeded, and where disputes are resolved peacefully through legal means in accordance with international law. I want to repeat that the United States will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, and we will support the right of all countries to do the same.
Mr. Obama's comments come amid growing concern about China's assertiveness in the South China Sea, where Beijing, Vietnam, and other countries have competing claims. The president also announced a series of steps that will deepen economic and cultural ties. The Peace Corps will be allowed into Vietnam for the first time to, among other things, teach English. Educational ties in science, math, technology, engineering, and medicine are being strengthened, as are climate change cooperation and trade links. Vietnamese budget airline Vietjet on Monday agreed to buy 100 Boeing jet aircraft worth more than $11 billion. Mr. Obama acknowledged the two countries still differ over democracy and human rights. Regional analyst Carl Thayer, professor emeritus of Australia's University of New South Wales, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Vietnam is seen in Washington as a success story in the Obama administration's five-year rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region.
They signed on to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, early. They will ratify it in June at the National Assembly meeting. And then securities ties are also on the agenda, and the rebalance was in part of reassuring the region that the United States would stay engaged. And the South China Sea dispute is center stage, and the arbitral tribunal is about to make a decision. And so Vietnam and the United States have a convergence of interest on that issue.
Well, what about the issue of China? China must be watching this visit very closely.
Yes, obviously. And a lot of people are saying, Vietnam worries about China's reaction. My sources tell me that after the last party Congress in January, one of their internal criticisms, what they'd been too respectful or too reticent to challenge China, and we've seen a much more assertive Vietnam come out of it. It doesn't mean aligning totally with the United States. It means trying to balance the relationship, but stand up to China itself. So they had Xi Jinping visit last year, Obama this year. They'll be able to make a judgment on how far to go with the U.S.
What about the issue of human rights? Will that be pressed, and will Vietnam resist?
The focus in the press is on individual dissidents, and that's certainly part of it. But the larger picture is the U.S. support for Vietnam's legislative process to bring its domestic laws under Vietnam's international responsibilities with conventions they've signed as well as its constitution. And if we look at the Comprehensive Agreement in 2013, paragraph 9, the last one was on human rights, Vietnam promised to do some things. It did. It ratified the Convention Against Torture and Degrading Punished Treatment. It allowed a UN Special Rapporteur to come in. It's improved the registration of religious groups. And it has changed laws on the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. So if we take a broad look at human rights, there's been progress. If we focus only on political rights, there's been the same backsliding and putting in jail bloggers who have criticized the regime and advocate peaceful change.
Well, Dr. Thayer, what about the legacy of the Vietnam War, the missing Americans still in Indochina, as well as the effort to clean up chemical herbicides?
The phase one of dealing with the major hotspot around Da Nang is coming to an end, and I believe the president will make a renewed commitment to continue the work to relieve on dioxin poisoning, related unexploded ordnance that will also be addressed, and that has been. The MIA question, as I've seen it raised in the media, seems to be raking over very old coals, and I think that the two sides long ago decided it was a humanitarian issue, and I think that Vietnam is being fully cooperative and compliant with its obligations in dealing with the U.S.
During Mr. Obama's visit, the third by a U.S. leader since diplomatic relations were restored in 1995, he will deliver a speech later Tuesday in the Vietnamese capital, expected to touch on human rights, and then travel on to Ho Chi Minh City, the country's commercial capital, formerly known as Saigon, to meet with entrepreneurs and young people. Well, here in the United States, a big social topic has been going on for more than a year. In Baltimore, the arresting officer in the death of Freddie Gray was cleared of all charges related to the young man's death. Gray died in police custody of April last year. International Edition's social media guru G. Abby Lee is in the studio. She's been following this story and brings us what's buzzing online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. It's interesting to see that the reaction to the verdict is very much divided. USA Today received many reactions to its tweet that reads like this. Baltimore officer Edward Nero acquitted of the following charges in the hashtag Freddie Gray case. And those are assault, misconduct in office, and reckless endangerment. One person wrote, when they are found not guilty, we are giving the police permission to kill people while in police custody. Hashtag Black Lives Matter. Other people still wrote, they are relieved that Officer Nero is found not guilty.
Which account have you been following today?
Very closely to Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blakes. She's someone you want to follow to keep posted on the city's reaction. She's on Twitter at Mayor SRB, that's for Stephanie Rawlings Blake, and has more than 81,000 followers.
Quite influential and prolific on Twitter as well. Mm-hmm. Well, what did she tweet about the verdict?
She shared an image of her official statement on the decision, and in the statement she said, police officers must be afforded the same justice system as every other citizen and ask the people to be patient.
And what was the overall reaction to that like?
Again, very differing reactions. One person replied to her tweet by pointing out that he noticed the mayor listed protecting Baltimore's property and businesses ahead of protecting its people. More than 30 people retweeted that. And to that tweet, another person argued prosecuting all six officers was ridiculous and that she wasted taxpayers' money by overcharging them. Now, for our listeners outside of the States, Freddie Gray was a 25-year-old black man who died while in police custody, and the officer who was acquitted Monday is white, further fueling racial tensions in the country. Jim, back to you.
Well, thank you for following that important story, G. You can tweet your questions and comments to this or any other story that you hear on our program to @VOA_IE. That's the International Edition account. And you may also tag myself and G on those tweets. We are @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. Here are some of the top stories that are trending right now in Asia that we're following on International Edition. Targeted Taliban leader was in Iran hours before dying in drone strike. President Obama says Mullah Akhtar Mansour rejected peace efforts in Afghanistan. At least 17 girls killed in Thailand dorm fire. President's visit to Hiroshima sparks moral debate. First Peace Corps program to launch in Vietnam. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on the VOAnews.com website, and also check out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Monday seemed to be another directionless day for U.S. financial markets, which closed relatively unchanged from the day's opening bell. But as we know, there are always significant movements under the surface that investors are watching. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino in New York is also watching these trends. She joins us with news of a potential blockbuster merger as Bayer seems to, or rather seeks to buy, Monsanto.
Monsanto is an interesting company to follow for many reasons. There's always that GMO debate, but this is an interesting deal. Bayer is offering $62 billion in cash for Monsanto, which would make it one of the world's largest agribusiness companies. And in fact, I believe it would be the largest foreign corporate takeover ever by a German company. We don't think that Monsanto will go for the initial bid. Expectations are the board would look to angle for a higher price. I've heard a couple of reports that some Monsanto shareholders don't want to sell to a German company. But we also have to think about what the antitrust hurdles would be here as well. You have to remember, this would be one area of the world holding a significant amount of the global seed source. And that becomes a tricky situation. So I think getting through its shareholders and getting through antitrust could potentially be some hurdles for this deal.
We're talking a huge amount of money, not to mention, as you said, the size of the company that it would become.
I think there's also going to be a lot of public relation hurdles as well. Pharmaceutical and consumer health companies tend to be more attractive in the public eye relative to the agrochemical business. Like we were saying before, that you see now on so many food brands, GMO-free is what they are pushing. And that seems to be the trend these days. So it's not like it's a love story for the public. There's always that perception that organically modifying seeds is not the best thing for our food source. So I think there's going to be quite a few hurdles to overcome here. So we'll see if this, these deals could take a couple of years to go through. So it really is anyone's guess. It's relatively new news right now, but I think it is really going to be a big hurdle for the public to really like the story.
With the bulk of the latest earnings reports behind us, what are investors looking at now? I'm sure Brexit is still in the picture.
Brexit's still really big right now. An interest rate hike on the table in June. Those are the two stories that we're really going to hear about. And this happens every quarter, every earnings cycle. Once we stop looking at micro issues like company-specific earnings, we tend to focus on one particular topic that traders will jockey around and trade. And that's what we're seeing, that really choppy, flat action in the market today. It's really anyone's guess if we're going to get a hike, if the UK and the Eurozone will separate. And that's really what the focus is going to be on. And, I feel like the more and more we have the same conversations on the topic, when we finally do get the news, we either get a muted reaction or sell off a couple points in the S&P 500 and come right back to where we are, because we've beaten these topics up for quite a while.
Whether the topics are the same or something new pops up, we always enjoy speaking with Jill Malandrino from New York. Jill, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
A glitzy night of music awards. That's coming up on International Edition. But first, as President Obama visits Vietnam, relations between the United States and the Southeast Asian nation are warm, more than 40 years after the end of hostilities between the countries. International Edition host, myself, is speaking with VOA's Natalie Liu about an exclusive 2004 interview that she conducted with the late CBS correspondent Morley Safer and his travels to Vietnam. Now, many of his observations from nearly 50 years ago echo current sentiments being shared during President Obama's visit to Vietnam.
Mr. Safer made a name for himself covering the Vietnam War, and is remembered today as one of the American journalists, if not the American journalist, who brought home footage and sights and sounds of Vietnamese during the war, especially their sufferings, shall we say, as a result of the war, and made Americans at home more aware of the casualties and costs of war to America and to Vietnam. In our interview, Morley Safer said he had particularly fond memories of Vietnam and the Vietnamese people.
I'm sure that had quite an impact on him personally, not only being there and meeting the people, but also because of that wartime period.
I think war is an event, shall we say, brings out some of the extreme true emotions of those who participate in one way or another. I think covering the war, a war, is definitely a way of participating in a war.
What were some of the other points that he brought up during your interview?
I asked him what he thought of the changes that had taken place since the end of the war. He was quite encouraged by the changes in Vietnam and pointed out that he thought over time the younger generations will in Vietnam will help turn the country into a new nation in a way. And he pointed out that Vietnamese, in his opinion, did not hold old what he called amities. Mm. And he said the Vietnam War was much more to the Americans. If I could quote here, the Vietnamese don't maintain, Morty Safer says, old amities. The Americans, he says, make much more of the Vietnam War than any Vietnamese ever does. He says to the Vietnamese, it was just another passing bad moment in a long history of bad moments. I read a report yesterday, and I quoted a young Vietnamese in Hanoi saying, Mr. Obama's visit helps bring closure to the past, which echoes what Mr. Safer was saying. Seems like Vietnam is a country that very much looks forward.
Natalie Liu, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your recollections of your talk with Morley Safer.
Thank you, Jim.
And before coming to VOA, Natalie Liu worked with CBS at their bureau in Beijing, China. You can visit voanews.com for much more on President Obama's visit to Vietnam. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. And while you're online, why don't you stop by Facebook and look us up at VOA Now. You can like us there. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The annual Billboard Music Awards were just held. You may have watched them. And they were filled with stars, emotion, and, of course, a lot of music. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London shares highlights with us, along with my International Edition colleague, Susan Yockey.
It was a night of awards. Some of the biggest in the music industry, I'll tell you, every star in the galaxy was inside
Of that
arena.
You needed to wear special glasses,
did. Well, to look at Meghan Trainor's sparkly dress, and all the other sparkles that were going on.
I knew you were
going
to get to what they were wearing right away.
That's not my area of expertise. However, I will say the big winner of the night was The Weeknd, who was nominated for more awards than anyone at 16, and he took home 8. And there were other big award winners as well, like, for example, Adele. She got the Billboard Top Artist of the Year honor. She wasn't able to be there in person because she's on tour right now for her album. However, she did video thank you, everybody. And Celine Dion came on stage, got the Icon Award.
That was her son that came out there.
Renee Charles gave it to her. She didn't expect him to hand her the award. She cried. She said, I'm trying not to cry. It was a very emotional evening for her, especially in view of the fact that she recently lost her husband.
And her brother.
Yeah, both of them passed away within a couple of weeks of each other. So it's been a difficult year for Celine Dion, but she's back on stage in Las Vegas doing her shows. The Grammy show opener was Britney Spears, who went on to get the Millennium Award. And Britney came out with the red sequined tuxedo.
Back to the clothing again, or the lack thereof.
And the top hat, and she looked great and sounded great. Love seeing Britney open up the show last night. It was a great show for the viewer and as well for the musicians who were all winners throughout the evening.
Do you think this is like the biggest award show this year? I mean, there's so much hype around it.
You know what? They call Grammy music's biggest night. So it might be that Grammy trumps Billboard, but Billboard's been around for a long time. The Billboard Award comes from a very famous publication the Billboard magazine that the industry uses, and so and has the many charts, including the official sales chart and the official radio airplay charts.
And I used to look for it in Jobs when I was a little cub reporter.
You did? You were looking for Billboard Jobs. Huh? Okay, well, there's no award for that, Susan.
Oh, not this time.
But, yes, Billboard is one of the big awards, American Music Awards, big awards. There are a lot.
Well, at the end of the show, there was a controversial moment in that some people liked it and some people didn't like it. And that's when they had a tribute to Prince.
Yes. There were a number of different performances that people chimed in on, including Kesha's very controversial performance where she is trying to get out of her record contract and suing her producer for sexual assault. And that's ongoing. And her producer, Dr. Luke, had a lot of say in who performed last night. And she said she was going to perform. Then he said, no, you're not. So they canceled it. And then at the last minute, they reinstated her. She got a standing ovation for her tribute to Bob Dylan. But the great performance you're referring to is Madonna, who came out to do a performance to honor the memory of Prince. Some people loved it. Some people didn't like it. It's, you know, it certainly created a lot of buzz on social media, both different ways. She performed Purple Rain. She brought Stevie Wonder out to join her. Now, Madonna is not your most likely choice to honor Prince, but she was his friend. And so the Billboard Awards allowed her to come out and honor Prince's memory with Purple Rain and another song as well.
Well, thank you very much, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
And now let's hear a little bit of that Purple Rain by the Prince himself.
I never meant to call you when you sorrow. I never meant to call you in pain.
You've been listening to International Edition. We're at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, and on Twitter at VOA_IE. Tracy Carter is our director. Jim Harmon, our engineer. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sub-Saharan Africa has done well over the past few years. The overall trends in Sub-Saharan Africa point to accelerated democratization, development, and economic opportunity, said Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield recently before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. A number of countries have ended long-running conflicts and are rebuilding. Others have held successful elections in the past year. Economic opportunities are improving, and per capita income has been increasing steadily. However, in spite of these positive trends, instability and conflict continue to bedevil parts of the continent, and much of that is due to terrorism and violent extremism. Terrorist organizations such as Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, and Al-Murabitoun are exploiting state fragility and political and economic vulnerabilities, said Assistant Secretary Thomas Greenfield. We see violent extremists focusing their recruitment efforts where there is a lack of economic opportunity, political and social alienation, poor governance, corruption of elites, and lack of accountability for abuses by security forces. In the Lake Chad Basin region, Boko Haram continues its attacks in northeastern Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. In West Africa and the Sahel, terrorist groups have conducted attacks against hotels and a resort frequented by Westerners. In East Africa, Al-Shabaab has launched large-scale attacks against the African Union's forward operating bases and other targets throughout Somalia and Kenya. And ISIL is attempting to co-opt local insurgencies and conflicts to expand its networks. The United States is working with individual countries and transnational organizations in Africa to boost their military capabilities and to strengthen law enforcement, judicial, and other criminal justice sector institutions. At the same time, we are working to stop the recruitment, radicalization, and mobilization of people to engage in terrorist activities. We are expanding engagement with African governmental and non-governmental partners to better understand the drivers of violent extremism and design effective responses. We are working closely with government partners at both the national and subnational level to adopt more effective policies to prevent the spread of violent extremism, said Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Greenfield. The United States is committed to partnering with the people and governments of Africa to promote democracy, peace, and prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.